We are Disciple Heritage Fellowship. We are a voluntary network and fellowship of churches that come together. We do pastoral care together. We put on a conference. We do this podcast and we help one another. And we're back on this episode, and I'm Sam. I'm a board member here at DHF, and I have with me...
Hey, everybody. I'm Chris Henderson. I was on here probably a month or two ago. I'm the lead pastor of Windsor Christian Church. I'm in a weekly study with Sam and some other pastors from our network, and so it's just a privilege to be able to get back on here and do this podcast again.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention, although I happen to be on here a little bit more than Chris, I am pastor in California at the Fountain Christian Church. And we do have those weekly Zooms, which have been such a big part of keeping pastors connected and healthy and not isolated and kind of stretching and learning from one another. It's really good. I think for me as a pastor, I really like to communicate to my church that pastors need pastors and that we need to go to church. And some of those kinds of things are met in DHF. But we're going to do something a little different than we've done before. We're actually going to turn the tables around, and Chris is going to interview me on one of my favorite topics.
Yeah, so with that, I know that Sam really likes apologetics, and he often gets a little bit of crap from us other pastors and guys in the groups for it. But to get started, I'm just going to start out with the question of what is apologetics? If you were to define it, what is it and why is it so important?
So we get this word, apologetics, and we hear it a lot now. It's actually kind of become a buzzword in terms of book sales, things like that. But we get it from 1 Peter 3:15, which tells us to always be ready, or really kind of the Greek tense, always be being ready to give a defense. That's apologia, for the hope that we have, yet with gentleness and meekness. And so it's a word that actually means like a legal case, giving reasons for, like a defense in that sense of, here is my evidence for what I believe and have hope in. And it's super important because we are now in a time where it's not like everyone goes to church. It's not like we have cultural Christianity where, you know, there's this expectation that you become a Christian. It's not like everyone has a high level of biblical literacy. In fact, a pastor not too long ago said they had someone coming to their church for like 2 years, and then they asked, like, what's the Old Testament, you know? And they were coming off and on, you know, it wasn't like this pastor was failing at teaching them. He was just kind of marveling, like, wow, I've kind of taken some of the level of knowledge for granted. But then we combine that with the level of opposition and the level of combating or conflicting ideas. And without apologetics, it's like sending soldiers out with Nerf weapons. They don't have the ability to combat some, you know, intellectually tough ideas that compete with Christianity and that a lot more people are buying into.
Yeah. And with that, you know, you talk about cultural stuff. So cultural wars, right? And I think that to a certain extent, it's not just the church with illiteracy, right? I think to a certain extent, it goes to the greater context of society. So how do you walk that fine line when we're talking about apologetics of meeting the needs of society, communicating these truths in a way that is palpable to somebody who may not know these bigger words that even we're going to get into a little bit later? How do you apply that in context? Is there a way to walk through that and progress through that? Even starting, let's be honest, right? Youth and kids. I think one of the biggest issues that plague a lot of our ministries is engaging our youth and students in a way that is going to prepare them to kind of face those different challenges that they're going to face once they leave the church and the family structure here at home and go off to, you know, a secular university or into a secular career. So is there a way that you've learned to kind of implement that strategy throughout the different age groups?
So there's kind of two questions there, so I'll break it up. I think the way apologetics breaks down, it kind of is a buzzword now, but really very often it's in two different categories. It's in evangelism, where the way we're interacting with those that are around us, you know, the end of Colossians talks about making the most of every opportunity with an outsider. And so you want to have a winsome attitude. And I'd really recommend everybody read Greg Kokel's book, Tactics. It's basically his subtitle is a game plan for, I believe that's what it's called, a game plan for sharing your Christian convictions or your Christian faith. But he's using questions. But basically, rather than being hostile, you need to engage individuals. And winsome is a word we don't use very often, but in a persuasive, friendly, loving way. Having been a full-time apologist on a college campus for 2 years, you know, I did see the guy angrily yelling with the bullhorn and the picket sign and things like that. And I can tell you, they could rile up some folks, but they weren't changing minds most of the time. It often takes, you know, conversations, listening, making sure that you're hearing the other person and they feel that you're hearing them first. And then you can get that relational equity and go back and forth and then lead them to truth. Just like Jesus met people where they were, like the woman at the well. But if we're talking another side of apologetics, you know, that side is answering real questions that people have, removing barriers that they, maybe wrong ideas they have about the gospel or Christianity. On the flip side, then we have discipleship. And it also kind of comes under that modern idea of apologetics. And that's where we get with kids specifically. And for that, the whole reason I got into apologetics, and it was my MA, is that I saw people intentionally in a church in Juneau, Alaska, when I moved up there for a couple of years, intentionally train the kids with the goal and the understanding that they were going to go off to college and have secular teachers, that they were going to go out into a world that did not have Christian values, and they needed to be armed with important truths. Very often, they needed to be not isolated, but inoculated. That means introduced to an error. Like, you know, you give the baseline truth for a few years, and then slowly when they start getting towards that middle school year, around that time, you start introducing, like, let's use some critical thinking skills. Here's what this says. Here's what scripture says. You know, why are these different? Or here's what this says that you might hear in the world, like, you do you. What would happen if everybody does you do you, versus what would happen if, as we follow Jesus, we put others first like we're supposed to do? And you help walk those kids through it. And then once they get past the middle school age, then you help them start practicing it at the high school age and start arguing for it themselves. So there's programs actually that will walk kids through it, but they'll even, Maven is a group that will actually take kids on mission trips like to Utah to talk to Mormons and things like that, and intentionally engage that so they can actually practice walking it out. One of the areas I think we often fell at in discipleship in general is that we'll tell people to share the gospel, we'll tell people to, you know, to do these things, but we don't actually walk beside them when they're trying to do it. And then so when they're out in the real world and then there's that moment they feel that pressure, they also feel anxiety because they've never really seen it done and they don't have anybody there to help them. So all those are like part of, that's a very complex and long answer to what you're asking.
No, that's really good. And I know you mentioned it, and so I'm going to ask about it. For those that don't know, Sam was a full-time apologist on a secular college campus. And so, you know, I think you're right. When people think of an apologist, they think of Rabbi Zacharias, right? They think of these great debaters, book writers, even more modern social media apologists, which you can debate whether that's great or not. But really, what does that look like to be a full-time apologist, especially on a secular campus? What does that involve? What did your day-to-day kind of look like? And what are some things you did?
So I was with Rocio Christi for 2 years at Ole Miss campus. And I have to tell you that there was plenty of boring parts. There was lots of paperwork. There was lots of fundraising because it was a full-time position. There was lots of paperwork for the college that you had to go through to be on the campus. But then there was also lots of fun parts. I had a weekly small group with college students, and it was really neat. I actually got to use a classroom at the college, kind of in their philosophy department, and I got to go in and kind of be there at a regular time, and we would have you know, plenty of students come in and we would have discussions and questions, and we would also have video series, just kind of like a small group that you would do in a church, but it was always apologetics focused. I also got to put out a table and do things like have a big, you know, whiteboard that says, you know, is there such a thing as truth, or is truth real? And then get people to come and mark yes or no, and then I would engage with them. And I had this one girl, for instance, who said, no, truth, there's no such thing as truth. And I said, is that true? And you know, she just got this blank look. And you know, like, is it true that there is no such thing as truth? And then she said, you're confusing me. And I wanted to say, well, young lady, you're confused, but I'm not the one doing it. Like, obviously there's something, there is truth, and we need to be pursuing it. So I got to do stuff like that, kind of engage, and organized a big conference, got to show off an old 500-year-old Masoretic text with copies of the Dead Sea Scrolls to show, you know, how we can trust the transmission of scripture. And I actually got to engage in a dialogue with some Muslims and kind of debate, but a friendly debate about, you know, which religion was true. It was a little bit more vague at the time. And that was really fun. I got to do that like in a fraternity house. It was a very interesting thing. So it was all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. The next thing is, I know we kind of talked about it even before hopping on there. There's typically four classical points, but just focusing on three right now, can you walk us through what, you know, cosmological, teleological, and moral argument is, right? And especially for those listening that may be lay leaders, maybe an elder or somebody who's from one of our churches that aren't used to hearing those big seminary terms. Can you walk through what that is, what that looks like, and kind of bring it down to layman's term?
Yep. I actually think that cosmological argument, as big as it sounds, is really easy to break down. Like, even little kids can look up and see and know that there's lots of stuff. Where did it all come from? And our society talks about there being a Big Bang. Well, who banged it? Like, if space, time, and matter, and now I get a little heavier, are all intertwined, and we know they had some kind of beginning, where did that beginning come from? Things don't begin themselves. Now, if you want a, you know, a more academic definition, you would, I like the Kalam version of the cosmological argument, which says that anything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, so it had a cause. And it's just one of those things that points to outside of time, outside of space, outside of matter. J. Winter Wallace, in his book Cold Case Christianity, kind of frames it as a crime scene. If we're looking inside the universe, there are all these evidences that point outside. So if he was in a crime scene and you see a dead body, well, there's all these bloody footprints that go outside the sliding glass door into the backyard. Well, you know, there's probably somebody out there. We should probably go check that out. And that's kind of the idea there. And then the teleological argument is the argument from design. And it's like, if you take a kid to Mount Rushmore and you say, the rocks just happen to form that way, they're going to go, nuh-uh. We are designed to recognize design. Now, that's true. Sometimes we can look up at a cloud and we can see design that, you know, isn't really there, and we can recognize patterns. That's true. And that's a fun exercise with, you know, we all do that as kids. Like, it kind of looks like this. But if you look at the intricacy of information, like the amount of, you know, not just gigabytes, but far more that's in our DNA. I mean, wow, the amount of information. And there's actually a law that says that information does not come from non-intelligence. And so we can see that there is information in our bodies. We can see something called the anthropic principle. Like, you know, we all remember with kids, the three bears, Goldilocks and the three bears. Well, we live in the Goldilocks zone as a planet, the Earth does. And so you can see that it is designed for us. As someone else once said, there's a certain point where you walk into a hotel room and you see your favorite color on the wall. You see your favorite TV station on the TV. You see your favorite snack laying for you on the bed. You see your favorite, you know, drink on top of the refrigerator. You see your perfect kind of pillow that, you know, you've got the My Pillow or whatever it is that you, you know, you want. It's there. And at some point you go, huh, I think someone did this for me. That's part of the teleological design argument. And the moral argument is really simple. Kids get this really easily. There are real moral right and wrongs. And although we could dig into it deeper, the idea is that those come from a real standard. And when we violate that standard, that's the wrong. And if somebody says, oh, you know, there's no really right and wrong, my temptation is to kick them in the shin. Now, I'm not going to do that. But if I did, what would they do? They would be like, oh, that hurt. That's wrong. Don't do that. And so we kind of bump into reality and recognize that there is actually real moral commands that we're not supposed to do, that aren't just culturally relative, that aren't just you do you. There are things that are objectively always wrong. A deeper philosophical version of that is philosophers will really ask people on the academic level that will push back and say, oh, no, all moral things are relative. They'll say, is it ever okay to torture a baby for fun? And people are going to say no. Well, and if they say yes, run from that person. But if they say no, well, then there's at least one moral law that all humans should follow. And if there is that moral law, who gave that law? So you combine the three, and then there is that fourth, the ontological argument. I'd recommend that you guys dig into that. It's a little bit more complicated, but it's about maximal greatness, and it's by a guy named Anselm. But there are some other ideas and other things out there, like the argument for the argument for being able to argue is actually like the consciousness argument, things like that. They're out there that all point to there being a God. And on a secular campus, maybe they're not going to listen to a Bible verse. Maybe they're going to hear some of these things. You meet them where they are, and then they can go, huh, you know, I have always thought the stars are beautiful. Oh, well, you know why the heavens declare the glory of God? They were designed. Let me talk to you more about it. And then you point them to the gospel.
Yeah. Do you have a practical or real life story that you can share that kind of shows just that point, right? Like, especially with engaging on a secular campus where you're dealing with a skeptic or somebody who thinks that science is always right. And so they kind of take that different approach. Have you had that experience that you could share where walking through one of these points or maybe all of these points, you were able to kind of move the pendulum in the right direction and get them to kind of go, aha, God is real. And I think you definitely did a really good job with the moral point. And I think C.S. Lewis does a really good job in one of his books. I can't even remember the book name right now, but he talks about that very point of it doesn't matter what society you're talking about. There is this common law of right and wrong that is universally, for the most point, seen to be true. And you're right, torturing babies. I don't know anybody who would be bold enough to make the statement that's ever okay, but probably should run if they do. But yeah, if you could just even real quick, just kind of a real life story of using these different points to work through that process.
C.S. Lewis, to follow up, he had this idea of, you know, the reason I was an atheist is because the world was so bad, but where did I have this idea of a crooked line unless I had an idea of a straight line? And I think that's straight from your Christianity, but I could be wrong.
I think you're right.
Most of the stories that I have are stories of people beginning to take their faith more seriously because of it, or overcoming issues of their own doubts. Because the biggest skeptic most people will ever meet are actually themselves. But I do have some stories where, you know, they moved forward or began questioning. The college campus situation often meant that I was just one step in, you know, in hopefully lots of people that were planting and sowing into their lives. There was one individual in particular, and she was actually leaving Christianity to join Judaism. And so as I was able to ask her, like, why and what have you researched and all of these kinds of things, I was able to draw out that there was no logical reason, but there was some emotional reasons, you know, like, as a boyfriend, that kind of thing. And it gave her pause. Now, I don't know where she ended up, but it gave her like, hold on, I need to actually look at what's true, not where I'm being tugged emotionally. Now, we can just pray that God continued to move that process. But there are more famous stories that I can't say that I was on the ground for, like J. Warner Wallace himself, who, you know, he was going to disprove Christianity, looked into it, became a Christian, or Lee Strobel, same thing. And so those kinds of stories do, in fact, happen. So J. Warner Wallace likes to say, people will tell you that no one is argued into the kingdom, but I was. And the thing is, the Holy Spirit will use these things. And that's important. But very often it's part of the process, and it points them to the gospel.
Right. Yeah. What are some tangible steps that we as churches or pastors, or even just as individuals, as the body of Christ, can take to do better at this, right? Or maybe to learn more about it. What's a good starting point?
I think number one, when you look at Barna polls as to those that have left the church, which is 70 to 80% of our young people, when they hit the college campus, and most of them truly, they left during their youth group years. They were hanging out in youth group and enjoying some pizza, and they were hanging out there for friends, but they were already essentially non-believers. I think one of the number one things we need to do is actually allow them to question things and have solid answers. And when we don't have answers, go with them to get those answers. Many times when they're asked, they will say, I asked my pastor this and they told me to just have faith. Or I asked my youth pastor this and they told me, you know, just to focus on something else, or that it's a mystery, or any of these kinds of things. And then I ask so-and-so, or I found this online and they gave me an answer. Now, it could be a wrong answer. It could be an answer that, you know, has been dealt with by Christians for 2,000 years, but because they got an answer from a secular source, they're going to start looking at that maybe secular teacher, atheist professor. They're going to look to them for the answers instead of the church. So we have to do better at that. And we have to do better at making sure that, yes, our children and our youth, they have fun. We want that. But also that they get prepped, that we realize, I think a lot of churches don't realize outside of kind of a church bubble, that the values are very different. The ideas about truth are different. You know, the way things interact are different. 4%, according to Barna, have a biblical worldview in the country. And so if you don't realize, I'm not telling you to be anxious. I'm not telling you to overstress. I'm just telling you to prepare your children to be in a world that's different, to be missional, to be like the early church, and recognize that we have to both love those that are different than us, but also give them truth, and also kind of take every thought captive that we hear, not just passively absorb a lot of stuff in TV and everything else, but to really be active and intentional.
Well, I think we need to be transparent, right? Maybe get away from some of the Christianese, I guess you could say, answers that we're even used to hearing when we were growing up, and be able to admit when we don't know something. But like you said, walking alongside them to find those answers and being transparent with them. So I think that's a very good point. But more importantly, I think we need to stop shying away from some of the answers too. I think we shy away from things way too much because it's easier to just go to a scripture or a Bible verse and say, here's the definitive answer, or relegate it to a matter of faith, which comes with mystery, instead of just digging a little bit deeper and walking through that process with them. So I think that was perfect.
Even defining the word faith, I think, is important. I think a lot of churches have this, whether they admit it or not, they have a definition of faith that actually comes from Mark Twain. Mark Twain says that faith is believing what you know ain't so. But biblical faith, or pistis, is actually a trust or allegiance based on what you do know, and it's in a relationship. Right. It's more like the difference between I recognize that a pilot and a plane exists. That's recognition. But if you get on board the plane and trust the pilot to take you to the destination, that's pistis. That's faith. And so we have to help the kids know that there's more behind some of these words, because they'll hear the words in the secular world and they won't know the definition.
So if you were going to recommend even, let's say, one or two books, because let's be honest, with sermon prep, lesson prep, and everything that goes on with ministers, or even just career and family life for those that might be listening in a lay position or from our churches, what one or two books would you say every person should read in regard to apologetics of the faith?
I'm going to start like real basic, real low, and then I'll give a bonus if you want to go deeper. Everybody should read Tactics, A Game Plan for Sharing Your Christian Faith by Greg Kokel. It's a great evangelism tool, even if you don't think that you're apologetically minded. And as he does this, he also actually addresses just some kind of common misconceptions or errors in the thinking that our culture has, and it's really good. And then if you want more pure apologetics, I'm going to recommend J. Warner Wallace's Cold Case Christianity, which actually has a kids version, and it has a small group DVD and curriculum that you can do all of that. And if you want to go a little deeper, the bonus would be I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Frank Turek and Norman Geisler. Now, I'll tell you that this is a little bit older, and the title is catchy, and maybe I wouldn't title it that, to be honest with you, because it might play on the word faith. Now, he uses that to get to something. There are some other books, but I think this has a whole lot of information at once. There's a couple of parts that are really dense, but it also does have some YouTube videos, things like that out there as well. And it has a student guide. There's actually if you homeschool, there's a homeschool curriculum tied to this for high schoolers, things like that.
Are there any sources or resources outside of books? Maybe you know of schools or different ways that churches and individuals can partner with some apologist or getting further training on how maybe somebody listening to this is feeling a call to apologetics and doing what you did as a full-time apologist or part-time apologist. What are some resources that they can look into and how to do that?
I went to Luther Rice. That's where I got my MA in apologetics. They're Biola. Is well known, and Talbot School of Theology in that area as well. And Liberty is now offering a doctorate in apologetics. That I have a friend that's entering that program now. But there are lots of different organizations that can help at a local level. Ratio Christi, if you have a chapter nearby or a college nearby. But also there are groups like Stand to Reason that you can listen to their podcasts, those kinds of things. And they have a few reality conferences around the U.S. that you can take students to. And it's really neat to see a room full of, you know, 1,000 students all being excited to hear deep teaching. And you don't often, unfortunately, see that in church. But when you get those kids there and you engage them with the questions that they're actually dealing with and hearing about in their high school, things like that, it really can light a fire in them. And then, you know, you can always reach out. I have a ton of contacts, depending on where you live, that I can point you to.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate all the work that you do as a apologist, as someone who finds passion in that and applying it to even your local ministry as a senior pastor. And so I just want to say thank you on behalf of the group for the input that you have in our lives. We're kind of explaining some of these things and walking through it and giving that perspective to some of us that, you know, though we might find it passionate, it might not be as passionate as per se yours.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a passion. And it's really because I saw kids, my first batch of youth, kind of walk away when they didn't have those answers. And when I was a young, like 18, 19 year old youth pastor, and then I saw youth get those answers in advance and stay in the faith. And that's what it's about. It's just arming them for successful faith and life, the Christian walk in this very interesting new phase that our culture is in, this post-Christendom culture. And I do think the change needs to happen at a local church level. And the biggest thing is, you know, just being aware, conscious, and having those, the best discipleship times, apologetics times, are having conversations about what people are struggling with and having doubts and questions are, and allowing that dialogue so that you can respond. That's really great. Well, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the DHF podcast. You can find out more about us at discipleheritage.org. And we hope you'll catch us next time. And in whatever platform you're on, please subscribe, like, all of those appropriate things. And we always appreciate a share. All right. Have a blessed one.